I'm going to start, and I'm going to start by, first of all, welcoming our other committee members. It's so nice, Representative Dabney, to be meeting with your committee. So we're going to each call our committee's order, and at a certain point, then Representative Dabney's committee will be adjourning, and we'll be continuing as a housing committee to talk some more about our bonding recommendations. So I'd like to call to order the Housing Policy and Finance Public Health Finance Division.
Good morning, and it's a pleasure to have this hearing jointly and find the places where the Housing and the Labor and Consumer Protection Committees have common interests and overlap in policy. I would like to call to order the Labor and Consumer Protection Division and welcome everyone. Thank you.
Representative Hayden, we're starting with your bill today. And I had just mentioned to Chair Dabney that part of the background maybe for your bill is what has happened in the past with some of the provisions that had to do with moratorium on foreclosure. And I'm just wondering, do you want to say a little bit about that? And then that should lay the groundwork for what your bill brings forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is, I think, the third year now that this legislature in different ways has focused on the foreclosure issue. And it changes as the foreclosure experience of consumers across the state has changed. In 2007, Attorney General Lori Swanson gathered a group of stakeholders and created what became two bills dealing with predatory mortgage lending. Those both passed and were signed by the governor into law, and that was just one piece of the work. The following year, there was a broad group of stakeholders who looked at took a more multifaceted view of the foreclosure experience in the state, looking at the experience of renters, looking at the experience of homeowners, looking at the experience of municipalities dealing with the consequences of foreclosure in their communities, and so on. I think as the foreclosure crisis has moved across the state geographically, and as it has unfolded and we've come to understand it differently, this legislature has taken different tacks at it. I know when I started focusing on this issue in 2007, my vision of foreclosures was a homeowner who was losing their home and did not have an appreciation at that time of the number of renters who were paying their rent and losing their home when the landlord was not making the mortgage payments. And we've seen in our hometown that actually in some years a majority of the foreclosures have been on rental property, not on owner-occupied property. In 2008, I carried the Subprime Borrowers Relief Act that would have allowed, that would have created the space that I think we're all still looking for. And that's the space where the lenders and the borrowers come together and recognize that a mortgage is supposed to be a shared risk with both the lender and the borrower experiencing risk in the process, not just the borrower, and creating a space where that loan can be renegotiated to something that is affordable to the borrower while still providing the lender with the funding and the profit that they deserve for the risk that they have taken. That bill passed bipartisanly in both houses. They did, frankly, better in the Senate than we did here in the House. But it passed both houses bipartisanly, only to be met by a gubernatorial veto, which was unfortunate. We will continue to, I'm sure, to work on this. Representative Hayden has stepped up and taken a considerable piece of the leadership here this year to deal again with both the experience of renters and homeowners in this process. This issue is not going to go away. It is going to be affecting more and more people as the economy continues to struggle. And I appreciate Representative Hayden's leadership on this issue and the chair's work. If I may, one more thing. The Labor and Consumer Protection Division has a new member. And I'd like to welcome Representative Loon to the division. She is taking the place of Minority Leader Zellers, who apparently has found other things to do with his time. So, Representative Loon, welcome to the division.
That just sounds like it's a sympathy issue.
Could be.
Thank you. Representative Hayden, if you would go ahead and present your bill. We have a number of witnesses.
We do. Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair. I am here today to, and I'm going to be brief in my overview of the bill because we do have a number of testifiers. I do want to say thank you for both of you for your leadership in this issue regarding foreclosures. And as Representative Dabney, Chair Dabney, has outlined, we started this a number of years ago, and things don't seem to be getting better. And one of the things in this bill that it will try to cover beyond the stay of foreclosure for folks who have been, for whatever reason, was unable to maintain their mortgage, it also has a lot of consideration with respect to the tenant, as Chair Dabney has outlined. We have a considerable amount of foreclosures. In my district alone, we have had a number, and also a number of high-profile foreclosures that have been in the news, where grandmothers have been taken away from their homes, that someone has come in and given a grandmother a ARM or a adjustable rate mortgage unbeknownst to them, and lo and behold, the ARM jumped and the rate was too much for them to pay. So not only are we dealing with this issue of foreclosures as it relates to people unable to pay because of the economic crisis, which some would say was really started with the predatory and subprime mortgages, I'm really, really concerned about the people who live in those houses, their legacy, as well as renters who are just trying to find an affordable place to live. The bill, and we're going to bring some experts up to really get into great detail, but the bill will require up to a two-year moratorium or stay on foreclosures and creates a set of new tenant rights that allows tenants to maintain residence in the home until the lease is done or until the folks are ready to move. We think that that is important. In Hennepin County alone, I talked to the folks last week, and their shelters are full, their overflow shelters are full, and they're now having to put people in low-cost hotels. So we want to keep people in their houses that they can afford, in their apartments that they can afford, and not continue to push people out into homelessness. With that being said, Ms. Chair, I will start to call up our list of testifiers. Some are homeowners, some experts on the matters, as well as folks from the banking industry and even the labor union. So,
thank you, Representative Hayden. For members of the audience who are wishing to testify, we've allotted about an hour for this bill. Would like to remain on time. I know the Housing Committee has additional work to do after the hearing on this bill. So we'd simply ask that folks be introduce themselves for the tape. This hearing is being taped, and that is part of our process for the historical record. So identify yourself for the tape, go through the chair, and be brief and focused in your comments so that we can hear from as many people as possible today. Representative Hobbs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. After the testimony, then will there be time for Representative Hayden to explain the bill or for question and answers?
Certainly.
Okay.
Representative Hayden, we're starting out with several homeowners who will be describing their situation, and then I think some of the witnesses a little bit later on maybe go into some of the details of the bill. Are
absolutely.
You comfortable with that?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay, thank you. So the first person we have down here is Saida. Saida Ali, welcome to the committee.
Absolutely.
And I want to thank you for coming. I actually recruited Saida yesterday, having heard her story. So I'm pleased you could come.
Thank you very much that I have opportunity to sit in front of you and to talk my problems. And I would like to thank especially Representative Karen Clark. I bought my first time I bought my townhouse 2005. Before that, I tried to organize myself and save some money to put down payment, which was $15,000. After 2 years, they increased the mortgage $1,738 instead of $15,600. I was paying for another 2 years the $1,738, and then last year, 2009, on June, I stopped paying and I asked for modification. It took 6 months, and I get response in January 2010, which they put down $1,400 a month and $200 association fee, $1,600. I couldn't afford it. Still, I told them that, could you please lower another $200? I can't afford. And they told me, we cannot do that. You can think about to have a short sale. So I think it's going to foreclosure February 15, and I can stay the house another 6 months. I have to evacuate on 2010 August. I have all the papers here, and you can look at the loan modification process. I was working with Washington County closely. There was a lady who was helping. Her name is Nicola Viana, and she's doing great. From now on, I don't know where to go and what to do. And this is how they break down the loan. They told me that on 2010 you're going to pay $1,400 a month. 2012, you're going to pay $1,500 something. And 2012, you're going to pay 5%, 5.20, and it's going to be like $1,700 again for 30 years. I'm not good at speaking in front of the public.
You're doing great.
Thank you. You can read the papers.
Now, did you want the committee to look at this? There is some personal information and we're concerned.
I don't mind. That's why I'm here. Okay. I don't mind sharing.
Okay.
So we do have documentation. I think part of what might be helpful to notice is the huge jump in cost.
And
could you just, I might have missed it, but can you tell the committee who your lender is, the name of your?
It is a PHH mortgage loan modification. I don't know, it's called a PHH, and I have the telephone and address here, and the loan number.
Okay. Any questions from committee members?
Madam Chair, to the witness, as I look at the your document here, what strikes me is the cost that the lender is proposing that you would have to pay for modifying the loan, and it's $18,000, almost $19,000
with my loan,
and you know, sticker shock kind of doesn't even begin. To say I'm something like 7 or 8% additional of the loan balance. Did they talk to you about why it was costing $18,000 to modify your loan to make it more affordable?
Yeah, I don't know why. And again, my loan was originally $261,000, mm-hmm. and I paid $15,000. It was $245,000. I paid 5 years. I think some goes through interest and some goes with the capital. Mm-hmm. And my loan become $232,000. And right now it jumps
$258,000. And Saida, my understanding is this mortgage company basically told you they were working under the loan modification program that the federal government has passed, and that this is their proposal to you, and this is what they offered you.
Okay. That's all I get the offer. Another thing is that the value of the house is like $208,000 right now, and I owe the bank more than the value of the house also.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Haas, did you have a question?
Yeah, Madam Chair. In the first breakdown, the principal and interest seems like a fair amount, the $1,074, but the escrow amount to me seems awful high. Does the escrow include insurance and property taxes?
Yes.
Can I ask where the house is located?
Woodland House. Miss Ali? In Woodbury, did you say?
I don't know. My house is about the same value, and my payments are $1,074, including everything. It just appears to be a little...
I ask them even if they do $1,000 or $1,200, because I pay additional $200 for association fee.
Yeah.
And I think I might going to lose my job even because I work a number of the organizations. So.
When you, if I may, Madam Chair...
House.
When you first purchased this house, you didn't rent it and then purchase it. You purchased it, you found the house by yourself and you liked it, so you went into the real estate company and gave them an offer. And did they provide the mortgage holder for you, or did you seek them out, or how did that relationship come about?
The real estate who was working with me introduced me to the U.S. Federal Credit Union, and I think it was very good, U.S. Federal Credit Union. I think after U.S. Federal Credit Union, PHH goes to the mortgage. But the interest rate was 5.2, 2005 was good, if you have a good credit. Mm-hmm. And again, they increased after 2 years because I think the tax of the place, the construction they completed, and it went to 1,500, so this the additional 200, so 1,738 a month, plus 200 association fee, that's 1,900.
Madam Chair, I think something that we might not want to overlook as we're going through each testifier and all the actions of the mortgage companies or whoever we're questioning, we should look to see how the house was purchased through the real estate company. If the real estate company provided the mortgage holder, sometimes that raises red flags for me. I've never liked dealing with the mortgage holder that the real estate company provides. I'd rather find my own mortgage holder. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's something that people get kind of sucked into, and maybe the real estate company and the mortgage holder are working together.
Thank you. Good point. Thank you very much for your testimony. I really appreciate it. And
I would like to look at this paper, how they break down after 2010. So it's going to increase more. Maybe because right now it's 3%. 2010 would be 4, and 2012 it would be 5.20. Then the money will increase. So I will end up being 1,738 again mm-hmm. for 30 years.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your sharing that information with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're hoping that the folks who are coming forward, by the time we get to the end of the testimony, we might have some ideas, maybe similar and beyond what Representative Howes was mentioning as well. Next, I'd like to call Terry Bark.
Good morning. I'm Welcome Terry Bark, and thank you for hearing us out today, too.
Welcome to the committee.
Well, I'd like to give my testimony, but I'd like, of course, to keep it brief and just concise to the points that have affected us. And so I'll state them as clearly. I'll read them off what I've taken. I live in South Minneapolis, but thank you again for allowing me to have this privilege to come before you today to present our concern regarding our home and to say why we needed and need a moratorium on foreclosures in the state of Minnesota. Our home, which we have owned since and lived in since 1987, has been placed in the sheriff's sale status with Hennepin County. Both myself and my wife are capable working adults with a combined income that can support a normal financial living and to make monthly mortgage payments to our bank. In the spring of 2009, my wife, Suzanne, had an injury which needed corrective surgery on her left shoulder. The contract agreement with our mortgage lender, TCF, allowed us to qualify for a deferred payment plan called Command Protection, but it was denied. Along with this, we also had trouble with the insurance company, though the doctor stated clearly that Suzanne's surgery was not in the classification of a pre-existing condition, and yet the claim was still denied. This only caused us to become further behind in our responsibilities with our house payments come late summer. I'm a business owner, I'm a landscape contractor, and in the beginning of this past season, it was more difficult in finding projects than in previous years due to the poor economy. Highlighting that our overall gross revenues declined nearly 70% from previous years, this greatly affected our financial stability in order to meet the present need. We struggled financially through what should have been our best months of the season, and by October of 2009, we decided to ask for any possible financial assistance from the loan department of TCF. Their answer was that there is no assistance to help us. We heard about the federal bailout plan, hoping that some of that relief would be directed toward people like us who are struggling, and of course we want to follow through with our mortgage payments. It went, we realized, to the banks instead. the TCF does not have or participate in that kind of support. By this time, we were overwhelmed and felt pressured beyond measure. What can we do? We asked ourselves. It seemed no way out. We did catch notice that an agency called the Minnesota Home Ownership Center was having an open meeting to discuss the foreclosure process in Minnesota. Ours, though, was uniquely different. We were already getting closer to the sheriff's sale. It seemed to us more gloom, somewhat hopeless. We walked away from that meeting confused, disappointed, anxious, and sad. We really thought that there was help for homeowners like us. Lastly, I cannot exactly tell you how we discovered it, but by late November of 2009, we contacted the Loss Mitigation Department of BCF. The sheriff's sale was scheduled to take place on Tuesday, December 1st, and we knew there wasn't much time to prevent that from happening. So we hurriedly collected and faxed the necessary information requested by the evaluator in the Loss Mitigation Department of TCF. We even visited with an attorney on our behalf, sent everything in via fax, and then waited for a decision whether there would be an extension of the sheriff's sale or to see within that department that TCF could find a helpful solution. But no word came back from the evaluator that we had contacted. So on the Friday before what I believe was a deadline to assist us in any way through a loan modification plan, which we had applied for, the evaluator simply said, we might as well go through with the sheriff's sale. It didn't really matter at this point, he said. He concluded by saying there are still options. I accepted his statement, but felt a little uneasy. I had no choice but to trust in what he said, and then I waited several days to hear back good news. There was never a return call or letter stating a denial. I called back several times and still no return call. We realized the hardship in which we're in the middle of right now. We asked ourselves what institution would reasonably consider to refinance us at a fair interest rate now. Who can we trust at this point? We are in an urgent need. What now should we do? We were told by June 1st, that's 5 months from now, that we need to vacate our residence. Has something been dropped? Is there still time to make amendments to our present situation? If this moratorium was law, we would have had time to find out. Our focus right now is to keep the house as our home. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Comments, questions from committee members? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bark, was this, when you went into this mortgage, was this an adjustable rate mortgage, or was it a fixed rate?
Fixed.
It was a fixed rate. Okay.
Follow up? Any other questions? If not, thank you so much for your testimony. We really do appreciate it and understand the hardship that you're describing. Next, I'd like to call Beth Hatch. Welcome to the committee, and thanks for making the trip down from Chisago County, I believe.
My name is Beth Hatch. We live in North Branch, Minnesota. My husband and I moved there in 2003. At the time, he was employed as an engineer, and I was working part-time with my own business as an animal trainer. Since then, in the last couple of years, Charlie has, who is the primary wage earner in our household, has had increasing difficulty in finding work and keeping it. And in December of 2008, we realized that we were not going to be able to make our mortgage payment in January. And we heard that the government was providing funds for the banks to help people with their mortgage payments. And so we immediately called our lender, who at that point had become Wells Fargo, and told them what the trouble was. We also called Lutheran Social Services and the Hope Now hotline for debt counseling. My husband had been laid off from his job on the 9th of January, and I was unemployed at that point and looking for a stable job. I had let my business go to someone else. things weren't looking good, so we asked to be placed in the loan modification program. In March of 2009, after a little back and forth with Wells Fargo, we heard from Wells Fargo that we should try short sale, we should try coming up with some kind of, they did say that there was a loan modification, and then finally on the 23rd of March, they told us that they were considering us for the loan modification program. In April, my husband and I both found work at a local farm. He was very seriously underemployed at that point, working at $7 an hour, and I was working in the office for 10, but we judged that it would be enough to pay a mortgage if we got into the loan modification program. So the bank asked us to send all the paperwork in. We did. We looked into the value of the home, realized that we were about $10,000 under on the value of the home versus what we could probably sell it for, but they said that if there was, if it became necessary, they would have an appraiser check. They sent in the HAMP loan modification trial period to us in May, and we were required to pay for 3 months to see if we qualified for their program. We paid all three payments early, and we're also able to pay all of our bills during that time, catch up on some that we had gotten behind on. In August, I called Wells Fargo to find out whether our loan modification had been approved. They didn't know. We had gotten a bill to pay the full mortgage payment of $1,336, and I called to find out whether we should pay the lower amount or whether we should hold on to it, because the bank was telling us that we should not pay the lower amount because it wouldn't go into the system. So I asked the representative whether I should pay that amount to them or whether I should hold it in escrow to find out what they were going to do, and she said she didn't know, and no one else could answer my question. So I elected to hold on to that payment. It wasn't due until September anyway. In September, Wells Fargo called to say that they would accept the lower payment and that we should continue to pay the loan by the due date, which is no later than the 15th of the month. So we paid that amount. They also stated that we should be hearing from loss mitigation for a final approval sometime in the next 45 days. The representative in loss mitigation told us that the program was a lowered payment for the first year through the fifth year, and then it would be increasing by about a percentage point each year until the eighth year, when it would stay at about 4.75% for the rest of the loan, which would be about 40 years because we were so far behind. We were told that we were technically still in the trial period and that our payments were going towards paying down the loan. In October 2009, I called Wells Fargo to follow up on status, and they said the loan was still under review. We called regularly. We'd been told to call on a regular basis, even though they tell you not to do that, because they said that what we had heard was that they wouldn't pay attention unless you kept after them. In November of 2009, we got a bill from Wells Fargo saying that our loan was in foreclosure. I called and spoke to the representative, and he said the bill was computer generated and to ignore the foreclosure notice, we were still in the program. He also said that while the loan was under review, we were required to send a new hardship letter, pay stubs and profit and loss statements and financial worksheet each month, something that we had not realized up until this point. He said that otherwise the reviewers would simply take the file and set it aside and move on to the next file, because they would look at the file and say that it wasn't up to date, and we would continue getting the message that the loan was under review. So we sent in the paperwork requested, and we continued to do this. In December, we were informed that we had not qualified for the home affordable modification because we had a negative property value, something that we had informed the bank of at the very beginning of the loan modification process. I asked them why they had put us into a program that would not allow us to get reviewed positively if they knew that, and they couldn't really give me an answer. They asked us to continue to update all our financial information. They said they were reviewing a loan internally for their internal workout options. On December 10th, I spoke with a representative, and she told us that the loan had been filed with the negotiator and that if it didn't work out, that they would go through their internal stuff, and that if the internal stuff didn't work out, she wouldn't. I said, what will happen if that doesn't work? She says, well, I'm not really going to tell you that. So on the 14th, we we got a call from Wells Fargo, and the negotiator called to say that Wells Fargo could not find any workout option for us. They said that we could apply for another loan, we could do liquidation, we could do foreclosure, we could do short sale. I said to the negotiator, I said I didn't understand why we were not approved for this project when, or for this program, when we had paid the bills on time since they had given us the workout option and since we had been keeping up with all our bills. And she basically said, well, your budget is too short, you just, it doesn't look like on paper you can do this. And I said, but we've been doing it. I also informed her that I had just received a raise at my work and that I had also received an increase in hours. And she said, well, here's what you do. She said, give it a couple of days to allow the loan to settle out of the system and then call back and ask for early resolution. Fill out all the paperwork, send it all back again, and then check to make sure that they get it. So we did that. On the 15th of December, we sent them everything and updated everything. We asked to be reviewed again because of the income changes on my part. And they did send us, in January, we sent the lower payment again. We didn't know what else to do, and we hadn't heard from the bank. In December, we received a letter from them saying that they had put us into another program. Now the payment was about half what it had been. So before we were paying almost $900, now the payment that they were asking us to pay was about $475 a month. And so I called the bank and said, why is it that we couldn't be approved when we paid the higher payment all those months and paid all our bills, and now you're sending us this new workout option with a payment that's half of that? And the person on the other end told me that the payment that they're asking us to pay doesn't really have anything to do with anything except proving that we'll pay the payment on time. And I said, but we've been paying the payment on time all this time. And she said, well, I know, but this is a new program. So the latest information that we have from them is that they have taken the payment that we made in January and they have applied it to the first two payments of this new workout agreement, and that we will owe part of the second payment and the full third payment in February and March. And they said that it looks like we will be approved, but we've heard that before. And it's been on and on and on. I will say this for Wells Fargo, their people, for the most part, are unfailingly polite when we call. But they haven't done any of this. And I said to them, why, if you have this money available from the government, you can't get it unless you approve people for these loans. I said, you have to approve some of us for these loans. We're proving that we can pay the loan. And they have no answer. They just keep running us through the system. We have neighbors about 5 miles from us that are through another lender, and they had been actually approved by the underwriter at Bank of America for a loan modification in November. And they still have received no paperwork that they told them they would get in 2 weeks. And they still have not been approved and run through into the new loan modification program. And it feels like, to those of us who are in the trenches with this, like the banks are just stalling. For whatever reason, I don't know what strings are attached to the federal money. I don't know what the banks have to do to access it, but it feels to us like they're stalling and hoping maybe our circumstances will change and then they can just go back to charging us the full mortgage amount. I don't know what will happen when we finish this new workout agreement, but if it happens like it did before, we'll still be paying the new mortgage payment, you know, at this 470. What does that even pay? I don't even know if that hardly pays our taxes and our escrow. I don't know if it's paying any down on the bill. So,
thank you, Mrs. Hedge. Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you started this, it sounds like it was about a year ago.
That's correct.
And when you started doing the loan modification payment, and you did those on time, you should be getting something from Wells Fargo that every month that at least tells you what your principal interest and escrow are. Have you been paying with this loan modification payment just interest in escrow Is it, you know, interest only and pay nothing on the principal?
I actually have to be honest with you and tell you I don't really know. I did call and ask the bank to send us a statement because we'll need it for our taxes, but I haven't got that yet. They did tell me that the first of the three payments at $900 that we paid to them in May went to pay attorney's fees. They said that the rest of the money that we have paid them since then has gone towards taxes, insurance, and paying down the loan. So I don't know whether that means we paid interest and whatever we could of the loan, or whether that means that we paid taxes, insurance, and and interest only. I don't know.
Madam Chair,
Representative House,
I'm not trying to hog the microphone.
Go ahead, your questions are good.
It seems that, number one, I don't think they can ask for a loan modification payment and then tell her that they put it to attorney's fees. You can't do that. You have to give them a bill of attorney's fees. You can't just pretend where you're going to put the money in and things like that.
So. Mm-hmm.
This sounds to me, and I don't want to be too bold, it sounds to me like a problem that could be solved maybe if one of the chairs would pick up the phone, call Wells Fargo in North Branch and say, look, we have a constituent, we have a citizen of Minnesota that we think has a problem that can be solved without us passing legislation. That doesn't mean we would stop on your bill. Don't panic. But this just sounds like one of those, you know, we all get them sometimes. We pick up the phone and try to help somebody, and there seems to be a lot of confusion. And there's absolutely no reason by law that she shouldn't have her 10, whatever they call that, interest payments for taxes by the end of the month. In fact, I would recommend if you don't get it, then you call one of us back, and we'll call the bank and say you better get it or we'll send the sheriff after him. But there's something about this particular case that just says we could fix this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Howes, I don't know if you saw today's Star Tribune, the cover story of another family that life happened. As it did with this woman, they're trying to make their mortgage payments, and simply a similar story of trying to get to the right person, trying to get the same answer out of the same person twice, and the difficulties. I wish I could tell you that this woman was an unusual case where, you know, we all know stuff happens sometimes, but I think this is a far more common story of, and I've never been able to figure out why, when I've been told repeatedly over the years, a foreclosure costs a lender on average $50,000 between the loss on the loan, attorney's fees, whatever else.
But they're insured for that loss.
Why they're willing to take that loss rather than sit down and work with residential homeowners. They do it with businesses all the time. But with homeowners, there's this combination of unwillingness and what I think can only be described as incompetence. You know, people file the paperwork and then the bank can't find the paperwork. And so they have to file it again and then they can't find it. And I wish I could tell you that this was an isolated story and a phone call would clear it up because somebody would go boom and fix it.
Unfortunately, Mr. Chairman, in my lifetime I've experienced issues with insurance companies or mortgage companies, and I know at least twice in my lifetime an insurance claim was never necessarily denied or approved. It was just in limbo. And one occasion I spent 2.5 years of persistence and finally succeeded. What they do is eventually you go away of your own accord and the issue is settled. It saves them a lot of legal and paperwork, and we have to be a little more diligent, and maybe we should be looking at a way to help these people become more diligent by providing, and I don't know what the word is, maybe an ombudsman that could help people sort through the mess. Because that's really what it is. It's a mess that the banks aren't willing to just jump right in and spend 40 hours that it takes to figure it out, because their hope is they'll just go away and we'll get our money.
Representative Hayden, I think you wanted to comment.
Well, just to this point, Madam Chair and Representative Howes, I think that your approach is logical. Your approach is practical. Your approach has a lot of common sense. However, that's the issue that we have here today, is that it isn't being approached that way, and that people all over the country are facing the same issue. The testimony that Ms. Hatch has given, I have heard over and over in town hall community forums. I was in Philadelphia earlier this year, and they have a kind of a workout that's a little different than ours. This story happens over and over again, and so I would hope that we could find a solution that is, you know, not as grand as just the stay of all foreclosures, but I think we would hire a whole division that's probably as big as some of our larger departments here if we were to hire ombudsmen for each and every individual that is coming forth that's saying that they're having this issue. That is what I sense as an issue. But I do agree with you that there is, if most folks had the kind of common sense practical approach that you would like us to have, then we wouldn't probably be sitting here and people would be finding some resolution.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your testimony, and we're going to move along. We have a number of other witnesses, and we want people to hear from them. Peter Brown, I'd like to call. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Peter Brown, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Peter Brown. I'm a volunteer attorney with the Minnesota Tenants Union. I want to pick up exactly up where we were with one instance and indicate that this, in fact, has been documented as being a very difficult problem. I would just cite to the news report by Chris Serres in the Star and Tribune, October 5. He says, through August, the Treasury Department said only 12% of those who qualify for relief under the Obama plan have been provided so-called trial modification. And further, Wells Fargo, the country's largest home lender, offered trial modifications on 11% of all mortgages that qualified under the Obama plan. What I'm suggesting here is that these kinds of studies, these kinds of statistics, verify that, in fact, the experience that you've just been hearing this morning is hardly unique, but in fact is endemic. Again, they're talking about people who qualify under the Obama plan. So what we're saying here is that it will be much more cost effective for this body to, in fact, call a time out. That's what we're talking about with a moratorium. We're calling a time out. I'd hate to see the fiscal note of what the state would have to do in order to basically put together the numbers of advocates and ombudsmen and so forth to deal with the 80% that are not even getting the trial to the trial thing. I think it was extremely helpful, Representative Hawes, citing the 2.5 years that he had to deal with a recalcitrant insurer. Well, the time period of our moratorium is just 2 years. We hope to be able to get to the bottom of things and get things running smoother in that period of time. The difference is that when dealing with a recalcitrant insurer, that insurer basically is not in the position to be foreclosing on your property. In the mortgage situation, homeowners do not have 2 years. I would just like to point to a couple of the statistics. I know where the time is fleeting, but I did submit into your packets two sets of materials. The first is under a staple that looks like this: foreclosure ratings fallings up for 2009, which indicates, among other things, that one in every 73 homeowners received a default notice, had a foreclosure auction scheduled, or had bank repossessed their home last year, according to Realty Track. 1 in 73. I would also mention, under that particular staple, is the article that I just cited. I'd flip very quickly to statistics indicating the number of foreclosures by region in 2009. It looks like this. And the Housing Link statistics for 2009 project through quarter three, 16,979. And what I indicate on this table is that just arithmetically projecting on that basis, based on that, the number of foreclosures that would happen in the fourth quarter, just basically keeping the same line, because those figures are not currently available. And that means that for 2009, 22,638 are projected. What we're saying is that this is a tremendous number of losses to our families, to our communities, to the cities in which these foreclosures are taking place. As can be testified again and again by cities, cities lose property tax dollars from empty foreclosures, declining home values, straining local economies. I will move very quickly to the second stapled item that I presented. This is information from the Minnesota Home Ownership Center. And because of the time, I'm just going to go right to the last page, and where that organization calculates the amount of money that they save localities by preventing a foreclosure. They were able to prevent in 2007, 5,000 foreclosures. That saved local governments approximately $90 million. Well, with your bill that is before you, you are in a position not only to save the 5,000 and the loss of that damage to the communities, you're able to basically save them for an entire 2 years, so that we can get to the bottom of what it is, what's going on here, why is there so much foot dragging. And on the back of the first set of materials, I refer to three particular articles that may be suggesting what is going on here. And I'll just quote this. But industry insiders and legal experts say the limited capacity of mortgage companies is not the primary factor impeding the government's $75 billion program to prevent foreclosures. Instead, it is that many mortgage companies are reluctant to give strapped homeowners a break because the companies collect lucrative fees on delinquent loans. Even when borrowers stop paying, mortgage companies that service the loans collect fees out of the proceeds when homes are ultimately sold in foreclosure. So the longer the borrowers remain delinquent, are you hearing the echoes from previous testifiers? The greater opportunities for these mortgage companies to extract revenue, fees for insurance, appraisals, title searches, and legal services. Stop with that. And available for questions. I think maybe I better yield my time for questions to next subsequent.
Okay, but, I appreciate that. Unless there's
anyone afterwards about any of this.
Is there an urgent question? Otherwise, we do have about three more witnesses. Thank you very much. It was a very helpful testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Allen Dale, I believe. Is he not here? Oh, he's not here. Excuse me. Okay. Lyndon Galboy.
Hi, my name is Lyndon Galboy, and I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee, but I'm speaking today for the Minnesota Coalition for a People's Bailout, which is a coalition of several different groups from social justice, religious, labor, and low-income people's groups. I'm going to try and be brief, and I'm going to try not to repeat what has been said. I do have a handout that summarizes my testimony. But this bill does two things. It puts a two-year moratorium on foreclosures in the state of Minnesota. The intention is that moratorium will affect owner-occupied properties. Second, it allows renters to stay in their homes paying a fair market rent to the forecloser should the place become foreclosed upon. I'm just going to go through some common sense reasons why this is needed. I'm not good on statistics and all that. But there's four main points. Is one, we have to save our homes. We've heard a lot of stories about today about banks stonewalling as people try to make adjustments. We have kind of a hotline. People call with stories like faxing the same paper to the banks over and over and over again. You know, being told to fork over anywhere between $2,000 and $4,000 to the lender, so the lender would consider making a modification. The person has high hopes, doesn't hear anything for months, time is ticking away, and then they're told no deal. And of course then you're much closer to the sheriff's sale and the foreclosure or the sheriff's sale. There's people who are being shamed and intimidated by threatening actions on the part of banks. And you know, you hear stories about people walking away, they give up. You know, the banks or others try and instill shame in these people. Some of the tactics that we've experienced have been banks just breaking in and changing the locks on the home before the sheriff's sale has even happened. It costs about $350 just to go to court to challenge a lockout like that. We've had banks cancel homeowners insurance on people without letting them know. And when we try to call the lockout company or the insurance company, their response is, oh, the bank told us to do it. And that they treat us like dirt, like we're the slime for even questioning what the bank said. So these are not legal, but they're happening. And that's why until we can get some things straightened out, it has to be fixed. And I don't know if you caught the part in Mr. Bark's testimony, but he had command protection insurance on his mortgage that was supposed to cover problems, you know, income problems. His wife had shoulder surgery. TCF said it was a pre-existing condition, so he didn't qualify for this insurance that he'd been paying for. TCF Bank told him his wife's surgery was a pre-existing condition, despite the fact that the doctor sent documents. I mean, come on. I mean, that's ridiculous. He was paying for that insurance just for that purpose. I'll go real quickly here. This bill does protect renters. A lot of times people don't know that they're being foreclosed on. Again, it's a thing of horror stories happening that aren't legal, but they happen. So we need something in law to take away that incentive for these horror stories happening to people. And finally, it's a simple matter of economics. I assume everyone here is concerned about the state budget deficit. Home stability is more important than ever because of this deficit and because of this economic crisis. Homelessness costs money. Everyone here knows that. I don't have to go over all those statistics again. It costs the state money, it costs the city's money, it costs the county's money. Empty houses become trashed houses, requires huge city services. Homeless families are cost, you know, as Representative Hayden said, the shelters are overflowing. And the state could take this thing that would cost the state no money and save the state a bunch of money in terms of city services, in terms of health services, in terms of education, as kids' education is disrupted, moving from shelter to shelter. It just makes sense. It won't cost the state a dime, and we think the state should do it to preserve the fabric of our communities. And now Deb Konieczny is going to give personal testimony for someone who couldn't be here today.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Deb Konieczny. I am also a member of the Minnesota Coalition for People's Bailout, and I want to read a testimony on behalf of Leslie Parks, and then have a couple of comments. I'm here today on behalf of Leslie Parks. She has to work today after coming close to losing her job because of all the time she has had to take to fight the foreclosure of her family's home. Leslie Parks lives in South Minneapolis. Her family has owned the building for nearly 20 years. Her mother owned the duplex and shared the building with Leslie. Leslie's 88-year-old grandmother lived there as well. Because Leslie was officially renting from her mother, The city forced her to do various things to repair the family's house, things such as storm windows and the like. Also, the elder Ms. Parks could get the little slip of paper saying that she could rent to her own daughter. Mm-hmm. Because few of us have this kind of cash on hand, Ms. Parks took out a loan on the property to get the cash to make the repairs, did a refinance. She told the broker that she wanted a loan just like the one she had, a fixed rate conventional loan. Both the elder Ms. Parks and her daughter have good jobs and had great credit and qualified for a good loan hands down. But they were lied to, given an adjustable option arm. For the first 6 months, the payments were what they expected. Then the payments went up. Then the Parks visited a financial planner who explained what kind of loan they really had. And as Leslie says, you would have needed a forklift to lift our jaws off of the floor. So of course they tried and tried and tried to contact the bank. They struggled to keep up with payments that went from 700, then to 900, and then topped out at $2,300 a month. They lost their good credit and all the equity in the home. The bank would not work with them, kept giving them the runaround until the property went into foreclosure. Leslie and her mother are fighters. They reached out to community groups, neighbors, and activists, anyone that could help. One action we did was a national call-in campaign to the CEO and the board chair of this particular bank. This and the publicity is what finally, this is what it took, a national campaign of calls from around the country, finally got the bank to agree to work, come to the table and work with the Parks family. Because of the support and compassion of the community and hundreds of strangers, the sheriff's sale was rescinded. They're finally in negotiations to try to work something out, but are not out of the woods yet. But we all know that this is just one case out of millions of foreclosures where the sheriff's sale was rescinded and it did not come by easily. Are all homeowners going to have to fight to keep their homes this way? And I would just add is that most homeowners don't have this kind of support. This is a one, you know, it's a victory. Mm-hmm. It's a small victory, but it's a victory. But most individuals going through this process do not have that kind of support, do not even know what is out there, have gone to the mortgage, organizations that are supposed to help with this are not getting the help or are calling their banks and trying for months until the time runs out because the banks are stonewalling. I also want to point out one other thing. This bill that puts a moratorium on the foreclosures is not new for Minnesota. If you know the history of Minnesota, in the 1930s, the Minnesota State Legislature passed a moratorium, a temporary moratorium on foreclosures, and set a precedent. This moratorium was actually challenged and went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the actions of the state of Minnesota legislature and said that the moratorium was justified because of emergency conditions. This is what we're in now again. We are in emergency conditions. We are seeing families losing homes they've been in for decades. We are seeing renters being thrown into the street because their properties are being taken. This is an emergency, extraordinary condition, and we really, really call on the legislature to act now and to help to stop this bloodletting that is going on in our state and with our families. So, thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Howes, did you have a question?
I have a comment and a question for the testifiers.
Okay.
First of all, our sympathy goes to the Parks family, but because someone tells you you have this interest rate, you really do have to read the contract. And I'm sure in the contract it does say adjustable rate mortgage, otherwise the bank wouldn't be able to do that. So it is a difficult situation, and our sympathy goes to her, but right. They should have read it.
Well, they were outright.
Ms. Galvin?
Excuse me, sorry.
Well, Madam Chair, they simply, even if they were lied to, you have to read the contract. That's the end all be all. Just because I tell you I've cut your taxes or I've done something, read it, because I could be telling you what you want to hear and not what really happened. But to the other point of this moratorium, I'm very sympathetic to a moratorium, but my question is this to you, in all honesty. If we put a two-year moratorium on foreclosures, who pays the bank, i.e. the business world, the interest due on all this money they have out there? They're not collecting money. They're not being able then to pay interest to people who have a $500 in their savings account, what have you, because if I have $500 in my bank, they're using that to lend it to somebody.
Ms. Gavin?
Are you okay that the bank still can get their interest in the end?
Representative House, the bill makes it so that people have to keep paying something. Unlike the thing where people walk away and go into sheriff's sale redemption period and are paying nothing, people have to pay at least 41% of their income in order to be in the moratorium status. So money will be going to the bank.
Well, and then just a follow-up, Madam Chair. If they're paying 41% of their income, that's fair, but let's just say that the interest on this particular mortgage is $1,000 a month, and that's high, but let's just use that as a number, and their 41% is $800 a month, so the bank is being shorted technically $200 a month. When the end comes, would the bank get that $200 that they've been shorted?
Well, the idea is there's 2 years to work out a deal. Representative
Clark. That's just fine. It's just a matter of having the...
Well, officially, we can't vote on anything now anyway, so right. It is a lot more relaxed.
Okay. Yeah, and the only reason for this is to help the people who are listening to the tapes later be able to understand who's speaking. So
right. Okay. There are 2 years that... the moratorium is there to work out a deal. It's not to sit there and do nothing. And presumably, it's in the bank's interest then to get the deal done quickly if they're really concerned about getting the money and come to the table and negotiate in good faith.
Well, thank you.
Madam Chair,
just real short because we got two more witnesses.
Yeah, just a real quick follow-up. I think just based on what she said and what I believe we're trying to do here, it sounds like we're on the right track. As long as the homeowner gets a chance, an extended chance, and as long as the bank gets the money due them, I think this is maybe very doable then.
Representative Hayden, sound like you might have another author for your bill.
Thank you,
Madam. I wouldn't go that far.
I'll be right over after the committee here.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hayden, here's another idea. Because I do a lot of work on building permits and some of the other things between the departments, we've had business come in time and time again, and actually we've now done it, putting time limits on how long it takes to get a permit, and or if they don't meet that time limit, they're automatically authorized on that permit, and there's no appeal from the city or from the state, and it's boom, they get to start building. You should probably think about that on the banks. Maybe with the state, I think it's 45 days or 60 days. They have 45 days mm-hmm. or 60 days to mm-hmm. do the modification or say yes or no. Mm-hmm. And if they don't answer within 45 days, it's modified.
I think
they're getting a good amount of trouble. I'm doing good at that this year. I'm Mr. Chair.
We're all looking forward to this legislative session with you, Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, I think that is a fantastic idea, and I'd love to work with you on putting that together.
Okay. Phyllis Walker, I believe, is here and wants to testify. Committee members, we have one more person after this, and then we will be adjourning to have this subcommittee, or actually the individual committee. Welcome to the committee.
Phyllis Walker, president of AskMe Local 3800, the clerical workers at the University of Minnesota. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, ESME Local 3800 is a member of the Minnesota Coalition for a People's Bailout, and we heartily support the foreclosure moratorium, neighborhood stabilization, and tenant protection bill. The banks in this country have received a huge bailout. It's time for working people to receive the help they need to keep a roof over their families' heads and survive this economic crisis, a crisis they did not create and they do not profit from. I'm here this year, as I was last year, to talk about the importance of making it possible for working people to stay in their homes. This year, as last year, we fear for our jobs, our homes, and everything we have struggled to build for ourselves and our families. This year, as last year, we turn to you, our elected officials, for help. Working people who are in financial trouble desperately need the help afforded them in the bill that is now before you. But instead of receiving the help that they need, the prevailing advice for homeowners whose subprime mortgage has doubled or tripled is to renegotiate the terms of the loan. When working people are laid off and cannot pay their mortgage, they are told the same thing. So working people who are in financial trouble take that advice and try to do just that, renegotiate their loan. But they are rarely successful because banks and lending institutions do not negotiate in good faith. They simply go through the motions and then foreclose on the property. Why do they do that? Is it because the homeowner who has been paying a note every month for the past 10 or 20 years can't be trusted to live up to the terms of a new agreement? Is it because the bank or the financial institution will take such a huge loss that they'll have to close their doors? Well, the answer to both of those questions is no. The reason banks and financial institutions refuse to renegotiate mortgages in good faith and reach an agreement that keeps working people in their homes is because there's a built-in incentive to foreclose rather than renegotiate the loan. Banks and lending institutions make more money by foreclosing than by renegotiating mortgages because FHA will pay the lender 100% of its loss on the loan. If the lender were to agree to change the terms of the mortgage and keep the house occupied, it would receive less money. Under the current system, we can't count on banks and lending institutions to do the right thing and work with borrowers for the common good because they make more money by foreclosing on our property than by renegotiating our loans. Unfortunately, when homeowners can't pay, many find that they have nowhere to go but out in the street. And if we think the crisis cannot get any worse, Governor Pawlenty's refusal to support a system of fair taxes to raise revenue could very easily result in the layoff of 1,000 public employees next year. Fewer people working means more households that can't meet their mortgage payments. Back at the University of Minnesota, President Brunix envisions a U with a 10% smaller workforce above and beyond the 1,200 staff positions that were already lost to attrition or layoffs in the last year. All over the state, working people are losing. When they lose their jobs, they lose their homes. When their homes are boarded up, the other homes in the neighborhood lose value. Neighborhoods with empty boarded up homes are neighborhoods where crime can easily take hold and grow, and then the whole community loses. The situation for working people is getting worse and worse. It's time to act, and it's time to act quickly. It's becoming more and more obvious that banks and lending institutions only care about profits, the profits they realize through foreclosure. As long as a profit incentive exists, banks and lending institutions will continue to go through the motions of renegotiating loans and then foreclose. Working people will have nowhere to go. As it becomes more and more obvious that banks and lending institutions' top priority is profits over people, we must look to state government for help. On behalf of the clerical workers at the University of Minnesota and working people all over the state, I urge you to support the legislation before you and feel the pride that comes from helping your fellow Minnesotans in their time of greatest need. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have an article that gives detailed information about FHA paying 100% of the lending institution's loss on the loan. I only have one copy, but I have a copy for you, and I'd love for you to read it. It's written by a lawyer from Cleveland who helps people in foreclosures, and it was on the website of the Center for Working Class Studies at Youngstown State University. I had been hearing snippets of information about this on public radio for a while, and I finally found something that explains it.
Thank you very much, Ms. Walker. We can, okay. We'll get it emailed to everybody on the committee so you can all look at it. And thank you very much for your testimony. I think we're going to just finish with our last testimony unless there's an urgent question. Okay. Tess Rice.
Madam Chair, as the testifier is walking up, I would appreciate it if you'd instruct the testifiers to try not to make the bank a monster, because a bank is simply 30 or 40 people working in a building doing the best they can, and try to not become too partisan or go after the governor. Let's go after the Senate or something instead.
President Hogg might be very pleased then with our next witness who will speak for the banks themselves, I think. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representatives. My name is Tess Rice. I'm General Counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association. Can you hear me okay?
It's better. Thank you.
The MBA represents about 94% of banks in Minnesota. Minnesota has the third largest number of banks in the country. We have over 400 banks, and the median size of these banks is about $77 million in assets, which is a small business, as you said, with 20 or 30 employees. Minnesota currently has some of the strongest pro-consumer foreclosure laws in the country. The general timeline for a foreclosure right now between the first missed payment and the end of the redemption period is about 420 days. We have worked with policymakers over the past 3 years on predatory lending laws and foreclosure laws, and we have supported most of them, but we are not able to support the bill that's before you today. Our members are certainly concerned about foreclosures. Foreclosure is a lender's last resort. There has been some mention about FHA loans. They are insured. They make up, however, a small percentage of the mortgages made in this country. We have specific concerns with this bill, as well as some general overarching concerns, but we haven't had the opportunity yet to sit down with the author, and we are happy to do that. That's all I have, unless you have some questions.
Okay, questions for committee members. I want to make sure that we do take that opportunity. I guess I have one, unless there's some others. You know, I'll get to you next then, gentlemen. You know, the description of what people are going through is extremely painful, I mean, and stressful, and it just seems unnecessary in many ways. And I'm wondering how you respond to what you heard here today in terms of, you know, the response being from the bank, we don't know, we're not going to tell you, wait until we get to the next step. The kind of human suffering and stress that I think we are aware of, in addition to the actual foreclosure itself when it happens, I think 420 days to foreclosure, I don't know if that means 420 days of suffering or what that means. So I guess I'm kind of interested in what you might want to respond to some of the stories that you heard today. There's been the suggestion that this was unusual situations, you know, but there's also been the statement that this is pretty common right now. So maybe you could just address that briefly.
It is hard to say how much is anecdotal, and, you know, it would be great to have some data that indicated what actually is going on. I mean, a lot of the information I've heard is that people aren't qualifying for the Obama plan because it has very strict income guidelines attached to it. So that's one issue. I haven't had the chance to speak with some of our larger members about this issue, but I think it's taken over our industry the same way the economy has affected everyone else, and everyone has had to adjust to it. I know our smaller members that haven't been exposed to foreclosure in general now are, and it's the last thing that they want, and they are not making a profit. They are losing $50,000 to $60,000 when they foreclose on people who live in their communities. But the concern is if you can't do that, there is no money to lend to other people. When a bank has a loan paid off, they're able to recapitalize, so they have more money to lend. It's an exponential amount of money that is they're able to lend. But if you aren't going to see a loan paid off for a number of years, that is a decrease then in how much you're able to lend to other people.
Just as a follow-up here, could you be a little bit more explicit about what the problems are with qualifying for the federal provisions? It sounds like, I mean, I think that would be important for people to know right up front.
I don't know a lot about it. I read an article in the New York Times that there are specific income limitations, something like 31% and 38% of gross income, something like that. So your mortgage payment is to be between 31%. Some people make too much money, and some people don't make enough money. And so you've got to fit in that sweet spot there in order to qualify for the plan.
Okay. We'll see. There are a couple of other questions, Representative Bloom. Or Senate. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Rice, do you have any information on, you mentioned FHA mortgages and loan guarantees have been mentioned. How many of the homes or properties that are in foreclosure are FHA? Do you have any percentages?
I have not seen any data. Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative. I have not seen any data on that. My feeling is it's probably around 10% of the mortgage market, but I would be happy to provide information to this committee about that.
Thank you. And if I could continue, Madam Chair, thank you. And do you know, I guess I just had a question about, you know, the 420 days of a foreclosure process. Could you really briefly kind of walk us through typically what happens if a bank initiates foreclosure, kind of the notices in that go out? And then just as a follow-on to that, I know I would imagine as we're familiar with as legislators, when you create a program, whether it's federal or state, there's a number of strings and requirements attached and can tend to be lengthy and sometimes some confusing paperwork in that. But are your banks of their own volition outside of the specific federal program, could you tell us kind of what you're doing to help do some loan mitigations or workouts? I know we've heard some, I think, pretty compelling testimony on people who are able to make, you know, a good portion of their payment, maybe not all of it. And it would seem to me that, you know, if they're able to either extend the period of that loan beyond the initial 30 years and the banks can be made whole and they're keeping up with their payments, it would probably be in your best interest business-wise to continue that. So, I mean, could you just explain to the committee what you all are doing outside, perhaps, of any of the federal initiatives that have been done?
Ms. Reyes.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative, I know for our community banks, the smaller ones that I mentioned, I don't believe that they have programs per se, but they are avoiding foreclosure at all costs, and so they certainly would look at any modification that made sense. When you have a borrower that has no income, it's hard to do a modification. I mean, when they lose their job, it's hard. Sometimes they just can't afford the home. We may be able to get some information from our larger lenders about what types of modifications they've been successful doing and how much of their portfolio they've been able to help, but I don't have that information before me today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up kind of on that 420-day process, could you kind of go through that? Let's say someone loses their job. They have no income. They're not able to pay, so they stop making mortgage payments. So are you saying for basically for 420 days, if no one is paying anything in the home, that it would be about 420 days before they actually have to vacate the property or kind of what the stopgaps are along the way?
Ms. Rice.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, we have a handout that has the timeline of a normal foreclosure, if that would be helpful for you, but that is the case. That from the time that that first payment is missed until the time the redemption period is over and the homeowner has to vacate is generally 420 days.
All right, thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Tess, earlier testifier,
Mrs. Rice that is.
Was that? Ms. Rice? Oh, Ms. Rice, yeah. I had it backwards. Anyway, the earlier testifier talked about the more some of these programs that they are, that they went into it saying that they were upside down, their mortgage, they owed more than the house was worth, but they were strung along, and then they were told after making all these payments to the bank that, no, you don't qualify because you owe more on the house than it's worth. And, I mean, isn't that a little bit like, I mean, the way I look at it, that's a little bit like bait and switch, that we're going to take your money from you and then tell you, nope, in the end we're not going to give it to you anyway. I mean, to me it sounds like there's some, I guess, abuse of these homeowners going on by the banks. And I've got anecdotal stories, and I've got one that's near and dear to me, where back in better times, where banks have tried to force people to renegotiate or get out to pay off a loan because they don't make enough on them because they're at the end of their mortgage and they've got low interest rates at the time when interest rates were a lot higher than they are today. And they were trying to get these people to refinance them and get them off their books because then they could turn around, like you said, and recapitalize that money and lend it out at a higher interest rate. So, I mean, I'm not, don't want to bash on banks, but I know a couple of instances where this has happened in the past, and it's the shoe's on the other foot and these people need help. It seems like the banks are taking advantage of a lot of homeowners. And I guess that may be more of a statement than a question.
Any comment?
Right. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative, it's very difficult for me to comment on a specific incident because I don't know what happened.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just hoping to understand this a little better. You represent mostly the community banks or smaller banks in Minnesota. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative, we represent almost all the banks in Minnesota.
Okay.
From the largest to the smallest.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Is there a difference in, you know, I hear from my community banks that they're not the same as the big banks with, that have maybe have a bank in every community, I don't know. But, and, you know, the larger banks, the banks too big to fail, kind of the ones that perhaps benefited most from the bailouts, are they, I mean, from what I hear from my constituents is that trying to renegotiate with a huge financer is very complicated, very difficult, and oftentimes very frustrating, and people give up before they actually have some resolution. I'm assuming that with the smaller banks it might be easier, and in many cases a smaller community bank has an interest in making sure the community members are taken care of in a different way. And I guess I'm wondering if you could help me understand, is there a difference in the way that banks are dealing with this, and should we? These are extraordinary times, and a process that worked for someone who was delinquent in their loan or wasn't able to follow through on payments might have been different if it were an exception to the rule. But where, because of the circumstances that we're under, there are more and more people experiencing this. Shouldn't we be looking at different ways of solving the problem and making sure that increasing numbers of people who find themselves in this unfortunate situation are dealt with in a way that's helpful to everyone?
Ms. Rice?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative, we just don't think that this bill is the best way to solve this problem.
Can you comment on that? Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you comment at all on the difference between the larger big-to-fail banks and the smaller community banks? Are there different interests there or different ways of dealing with this?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative, there's a difference if you have a bank in a small community that makes a mortgage and portfolios that mortgage. They hang on to that mortgage, which would be different than a bank that is selling it on the secondary market and securitizing those, and then you have a servicer for that. And I think that's what we're all dealing with right now. Mortgage funds were cheaper this way, you know, with these investors to purchase them. You wouldn't have even looked at a community bank's rates probably, because the rates offered through the secondary market were so much better. But now it's hard to find the face for some of these mortgages, whereas if you had borrowed from a bank that held on to your loan that you can walk into and talk to someone, you're going to have a different result.
Okay. To that point, Representative Benson?
Not particularly.
Oh, okay, okay. I think Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know this isn't necessarily an issue also with home mortgages. It's also the commercial market lending has gotten tightened up quite a bit, too. when I've been talking to our banks recently, they really feel they have their hands tied because of the federal examiners that have been really clamping down on them, that their portfolios, that the loans have a higher percentage of equity than they had originally done. And so they really have had their hands tied on what they would like to do versus what they have to do. Can you comment on that?
Ms. Reyes.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative, that is the experience of a lot of our banks. Examiners are very concerned about concentrations in a bank's portfolio, too many loans made in one area. And so banks don't make a lot of car loans anymore. Those are tend to be made at the dealership. They don't make a lot of student loans. Those are done through Sally Mae or whatever it is. And so, and then a lot of the mortgage loans were being made by brokers and sold on the secondary market. And so commercial lending was kind of the last bastion for banks. And so they do end up having concentrations. A lot of their loans are in those areas, and examiners are coming in and finding fault with that now where they may not have in the past because they're worried about those values dropping. They're requiring new appraisals, that kind of thing, requiring aggressive writing off of those loans from their books. So, yes, they are struggling with that issue.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just gave a comment, really, because I've been in and out, and it wouldn't be fair of me to ask for, you know, a review of all the things that have already been discussed. But we went through this issue before, and Representative Dabney had presented a completely reasonable bill to deal with foreclosure. Unfortunately, as he mentioned, the governor chose to veto that, but I have to say that during the discussion, as I remember it, even though those who were representing community banks, who are basically not so much involved in this problem, we're talking about large banks who were running Ponzi schemes at the expense of homeowners, the community bankers' representative also opposed on ideological reasons that somehow, no matter how severe the situation was for homeowners, that we had to maintain protection for banks from the interference of the government again, whether it was the state or the national level. In that they were perfectly willing to forget all about their fiduciary responsibility that you do not lend loans to people who cannot pay them back. And for the banks to come here and then say, well, now the people who were foolish enough to take those loans should pay the full consequence for these Ponzi schemes that were running, this bundling of these loans, I think is unreasonable. And the time when I was selling residential real estate, I was watching the loan officers and noticing that when they wrote those loans, they always got a commission, and those commissions went on to other levels, and these people were making lots of money at other people's expense. So I hold all those who had a fiduciary responsibility not to lend to people who couldn't buy and couldn't pay. I certainly did that. I didn't show homes to people who had no chance to be able to meet their loan responsibilities. Sure, they shouldn't have done it. But there are all kinds of reasons that people get themselves into these fixes, and those who at least run the institutions ought to have the decency not to exploit people and send our economy into a tailspin. So as far as I'm concerned, I have no sympathy for the banks and their concerns now. They should have thought about that before they ran their Ponzi schemes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. And I think Representative Powers has a comment, and then we're going to ask Representative Hayden to make some final points, and we'll be done.
Madam Chair, I have a comment and a question for the witness. In defense of a few, I know the TCF did not take a federal buyout, so I think that they might be one of the exceptions to the case. I've worked with Wells Fargo over the years with my mortgages. They've always been fair. So when a member says that the banks are crooks, I think you have to be, well, you didn't use that word, but some. you kind of said all. So I think it'd be better for us to pay attention to those that are doing wrong rather than putting them all in the same category. That being said, ma'am, would you be willing, and I would recommend that you be willing, as a conservative Republican who would normally oppose this, I would say, I would ask you to work with Representative Hayden, bring your people in, invite me in with you, and come to an agreement as to something that you could work with. Because if Representative Hayden claims he has this bill to put a moratorium on, and other folks that have testified said they're okay if the banks still get their money in the end, I would think you would want to be willing to look at that real hard and work with him and have him put something together that you can, maybe you're not going to love it, but you're going to like it enough where it's okay, rather than have us bring a bill forward that for 3 months you're just going to hate. And in the end, you might have it, but then you didn't work with us to make it more palatable. So I would like her to really work hard at that.
Thank you, Representative Hollis. Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we have had a great discussion today. I think that we have seen that because of a lot of factors that have happened, people are challenged with the place in which they are living. And what I want to focus on, beyond all of the things that we have to work out and the gracious help from Representative Hawes and the Bankers Association, is I want to leave you with primarily this is a place where people live. This is a place where people raise their children. This is a place in which people create their family legacies. And so the spirit of this bill is just that. It is to keep people in their homes. It is to give people an opportunity to work out a plan in which they can live at their homes. There is many and much blame to be laid on this issue and why and where. I had a friend who's in the mortgage business who told me that he doesn't do remodifications because there isn't any money, literally, for him, which speaks to Representative Benson's issue, for him in doing these modifications, loan modifications, due to the process, et cetera. Anecdotally, there are a lot of reasons why this doesn't happen. I think that this is a great opportunity for us, as we continue to move forward and times seem not to be getting better, for us to stabilize people in their homes, to allow them to put a good faith effort with the banks in order to do so. So with that being said, I won't take up any more of your time. I really appreciate this for your consideration, and I appreciate the chairs for hearing this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To explain to the audience and to members what's going to happen now is, recall that this is a joint committee hearing. The Labor and Consumer Protection Division will now adjourn. The Housing and Public Health Finance Committee will continue and has important work to do. So not everybody gets to leave, but a number of us do. The Labor and Consumer Protection Division is now adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thorne. We hope you come back and visit again. So, committee members, let's just take about a 3-4 minute break here. Just catch your breath. We're going to come back and talk some more about the bonding bill. So, good job.
And please ignore my chicken scratch at the top. I don't
know. Hey, which Larry? There's so many Larry's on the top. Which one is the
We're against doing it. Now we've got thousands more people.
Thanks for that. he's a little further west. North? Someplace.
Okay, so you gave up the sweets, but not the chocolate.
No,
not
really.
I think rather than that,
south of St.
Okay. Which particular issue would this be like the federal government?
So can I bring like special K bars? Oh, they have chocolate. Chocolate candy bar. Yeah. You know what? How many calories are in that? How many calories?
Hey, do I need to bring this to
you? Oh, Jake. Give it to Jake.
Sounds good.
He's right there.
Ready?
A month ago?
I think I saw you in your
husband.
Oh, no. Well,
yes, actually. Oh, yeah, actually, there was like. Yeah, I probably was to marry. Was it around the holidays?
Yeah.
Okay, yep. We took part after that.
Yeah,
that's how I would have played.
Jake, can you help me hand this out?
Yeah.
Can you get the answer? Hey, Matt, we pulled the amendment. It didn't came out to go in there. We're talking any of the bills.
Okay. Yeah. Probably. Yeah.
Good hard work.
Sorry, I missed yesterday.
Oh, you were exploding in trouble? Oh my gosh.
I could sense it.
We get a special detention.
I could sense it.
That's amazing. I've got these two, just so. Okay.
Yeah?
Hi.
Nice to you.
Yeah. We can.
Oh, okay.
Just go to Mary
Bell. Oh, okay.
That's okay. We did just fine. Don't worry about it.
And you are?
I'm Jake.
Jake, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Jennifer. I'd take your hand, but we wouldn't fit. You think you can?
All right.
You
want
to do it?
Yeah, just
the
labor and consumer protections.
Oh.
For him to give up his.
Hell, don't these people know where they live?
Thanks, Mary. Did they give them out to you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you could just put in a moment when we're done here, when we're set up. I guess he needs it, yeah.
No, I mean, you could just, you don't have to have it today.
Yeah.
But if you could send it to me sometime the next day or two, sure. That'd be great. Because I know that Monday I'll be meeting.
Card, then we'll make sure.
Yeah, if you have my information, right? Yeah. Jake? Yep. Yeah, my, my
yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Thanks, Jay. Yep. I like that timer. Thanks. Yeah.
Seriously. Of all the papers I handled yesterday, not one single paper cut. Today, not the same story.
Did you get everyone around here already?
Yeah.
13,
14? Uh huh. I think so. And then now we just need one more that goes around.
I'm not sure if anyone's who's coming back. So, yeah. I think Rosenthal's an hour. I think McFarland's an hour. I think House is leaving.
I don't think I gave House.
all the bills. Okay, so that's the article from Jeff Hayden's Although we're like a half hour.
You don't have to give one to Jeff Hayden, but I took his.
Okay.
Yep, no problem.
Yeah, I wanted something for the folks who have been on.
Oh, good. David's here too. Okay, well.
Okay.
We're going to have a little discussion with people that are here, yes.
All right. Well, thank you.
That's the problem, everybody.
Oh, Carol's going to choose it.
Okay.
All right. Good job, good job. Oh, good job. Look at this one. You never know what that house is going to go with you.
I know.
He sneaks back around and then he's on his
side. I have a 12:30 hearing for transportation. Just in case that when you're ready to go.
Just the bills that we had the other day.
That's where you really get the best information.
Yeah, I know.
What is that? You don't get it back. I didn't want to hand her the whole crowd.
We can get them.
But she was saying we were going to jackets.
No, no, not. And then they just put a
file. That's right.
Totally goes with these folks' testimony that every time they call, they're talking to a different person who has no idea what they're doing. And they train them on being polite, but they have no idea.
So many times from my
It's a tip. They have
a lost my papers. They don't know where they are.
Yeah.
They have to be filed.
Short-term employees that are, you know, getting paid $12 an hour, no one's sooner. All of these good mortgage brokers are serious ones that get the commissions.
Committee members, I'm going to call the meeting to order. I think we're going to see if we can round up a few more of our folks, and maybe it was a mistake to let everyone have a little break, but I've been sitting here quite a long time, so it seemed kind of the humane thing to do. The purpose of this part of the meeting, though, is just to, again, get some final advice. As you know, as the chair, I need to submit a letter, a memo to the chair of the bonding committee, making clear what our recommendations are in terms of bonding for the housing issues that are before us. And so we have, four bills, I guess, that we've had considered. My own bill, Representative Mariani's bill, Representative Benson's bill, and Representative Nelson's bill. And so we've just provided those all to you again to look at briefly. And then I guess I just want to have a bit of a discussion, and we have Minnesota Housing Finance Agency with us here today, and others who may want to make a few comments, but I guess I wanted to just hear from committee members. I did meet with both the Republican and Democratic members of our committee. I have to say, we missed quite a few folks on both sides. So speak now, because this is a chance to, you know, kind of have some final thoughts if you haven't had those before, or if you've had some more thoughts since we had our smaller meeting. There's some documents that you can look at. I think you all have in your packet, do they have this? There's a discussion on bonding materials. Discussion materials. And so we have a governor and agency proposal before us, and you know what that is. folks are familiar with that. Maybe we should just ask the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency just to review that for us again, just in case any folks who might have missed that hearing. I'm not sure if we're all there. And would you mind? Thank you, Ms. Orr, for coming down. Okay, thank you. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Tanya Orr from the Housing Finance Agency. You would like me to review our request or the governor's recommendation?
You know, I think both are appropriate, actually, to this committee, because I
was sort of hoping that would be the case.
Yes, yes, you bet.
Madam Chair, members, the agency submitted, depending upon how you look at it, two or three requests for capital investment. We submitted a request around foreclosure recovery efforts and supportive housing. We asked for, as you may recall, 2 years ago, you established a new funding mechanism in the capital investment bill for the Housing Finance Agency, which is to use nonprofit housing bonds as opposed to GO bonds to fund housing needs. The advantage of that is that it's difficult to have public ownership of housing in many cases, so which was required with GO bonds. So we asked for $30 million of nonprofit housing bonds to be authorized and the debt service to be appropriated on those bonds. The debt service on $30 million would be approximately $2.4 million a year, every year for 20 years. The money would be used for, at our request, would be used for three particular purposes. For rental housing in that has been foreclosed or vacant, to acquire that rental housing, rehab it, and then rent it to low-income and moderate-income families for 20 years. The properties would be owned by nonprofits, and the idea was that the properties would, the rents would be able to be set at operating costs as opposed to operating costs plus your debt service, because the state would be paying the debt service, so that we could keep the rents low for a period of a minimum of 20 years. We also are suggesting that $27.5 million for rental housing be available to continue our work on the plan to end long-term homelessness. We are constrained somewhat by the development of new supportive housing units by the lack of service funds, but we are confident that we can cobble together service funds for some supportive housing units in the future, and we wanted to have that flexibility so that if we were able to, as I said, cobble together supportive services, we would have the capital funds to match that and continue to make progress on our long-term homeless business plan. As you know, we're over halfway there in terms of the number of housing opportunities we had set as a goal. And until 2009, we exceeded our goal every year. And we've funded over 2,600 housing opportunities and have over 1,500 households actually housed. We also are seeing really positive outcomes in terms of the length of time that people are staying, or if they're moving, they're moving to permanent housing. So we're seeing really good outcomes, exactly what we expected from this effort. Going back to the foreclosure issue, we see with the NSP funds that communities are investing in single-family homes, home ownership for the most part. There is a fair amount of rental housing. Hennepin County had about 10% of their foreclosures were on multi-unit buildings. And there's a lot of single-family rental housing as well that's being foreclosed. It's an important part of the housing stock. It will help neighborhoods recover more quickly if we can take some of these apartment buildings and duplexes and triplexes and get them back into the in good condition and occupied. There is a fair amount of literature about the need when you have a distressed neighborhood about sort of concentrating your efforts in those neighborhoods as opposed to spreading your money all over. And that would be part of our proposal, is to really target the areas that are most distressed and try and get them to the point where the private sector is making good investments in the neighborhoods. So we had $27.5 million requested for rental housing. We also requested $2.5 million for community land trusts. This, again, is related primarily to foreclosure recovery efforts, the idea being that the land trusts could use this money to acquire land, and the home buyers would take a mortgage on the building and lease the land from the land trust, and that would keep the property in the affordable housing home ownership realm for a long period of time. We also were going to use this money to help land trusts acquire homes along transit corridors so that we could preserve affordability in areas that once the transit systems go through are likely to experience increased property values and making it more difficult for low-income people to continue to live in those areas. Our final request, so those two requests totaled $30 million of bonds. The debt service on those bonds, which is what our ask is for appropriations of $2.4 million for the next 20 years to pay off those bonds. And then we had a $10 million request for GO bonds for public housing to rehab public housing across the state. Public housing houses the lowest income people in the state. Two-thirds of the population is elderly or disabled. Most of the public housing is fairly old. It's in need of a lot of repair. Unfortunately, the federal government has not contributed as much as it is needed to maintain those properties. They are recognizing that they have failed to live up to their responsibilities and are asking Congress for more money. But we have a situation where a number of the public housing authorities are having to do things like sell their properties because they can't afford to maintain them. So they sort of have to marshal their resources and consolidate them. People are living in not very good environments. As some of you were on the tour in Albert Lea, they had a ventilation system that had needed to be replaced for the last 10 years. People live in apartments where they have windows, but they don't have any cross ventilation, and they have a really bad, old, antiquated ventilation system. So this it's not the best environment for people. The money that we were requesting would help do things like bring the buildings, make them more energy efficient, address sort of health and safety issues. And we still see this as sort of a temporary need until the federal government gets back in the game more.
Okay. Comments or questions from committee members? Well, we had a conversation in your office the other day to talk a little bit about this issue too, and I appreciated that. And I'm just left with a quandary here of how we are going to solve this problem. We're trying to figure out what the options are and what other advice or ideas the agency might have. One of the questions that I've been trying to figure out is if we were to go even just with the governor's recommendation. My understanding is this committee has to come up with $400,000 in cash, which we do not have. We have zero, and in fact, we'll be asked to make cuts. So I'm just wondering what the agency might have in mind or recommend where we would, in your budget, which is where we will be asked to come up with those dollars, if you have some advice for us on what we might do with that, because it's not a pretty picture, and we're not very happy about that, but that is the situation. And I know that you have some bonding opportunities that you have utilized, like in the past. I think after the session with foreclosure, you used some bonding authority to help with some situations that were evolving, I think, in Minneapolis. And I'm just wondering if through that or other ways you might have some suggestions for us.
Madam Chair, I'm afraid I don't have very good suggestions. When we first approached the Department of Finance about an alternative to GO bonds, part of our discussion was that if we pursued this alternative to GO bonds, that we would do so in the context of the capital investment bill, and that we would essentially compete with all other interests for capital investment money. As you may recall, 2 years ago, when the $30 million for nonprofit housing bonds was authorized and the debt service was appropriated, it is treated as though it's general, it's GO bonds debt service. So it's in the Department of Finance. It is not out of your budget. I frankly think our advice probably would be, if we're talking about reducing the agency's base budget for the next 20 years to fund these bonds, we would have to really think long and hard about whether that's a good trade-off. That was, you know, as I said, we in our minds and in our discussions with the Department of Finance, is a different funding mechanism, but it was going to be treated as though, in terms of all the negotiations, as though these were GO bonds, and that the money, that the debt service, just as in the past you have funded GO bonds with the agency, you've not been asked to pay for the debt service on those GO bonds. And so in that regard, we assumed that that would be the treatment going forward, and it does change the request considerably if it's going to be treated like another line item in our budget. That's a totally different animal, and I think we would really need to talk about, is that what we want to spend, let's say, $400,000 on, or is there some other use for that? I don't have a good suggestion. The bonding that you've referred to, as you know, nearly 50% of the agency's total budget is from bond revenues. Those are the bonds that we issue, except for these nonprofit housing bonds, are revenue bonds. They are not appropriation bonds. They are bonds where we're telling the bondholders that we're making good loans to homeowners who are going to repay those loans, and then we will be able to, from those revenues, pay the bondholders the money that we owe them. So we have to be able to make loans that will generate revenues to pay the bondholders. If we could issue bonds for rental housing, and do issue bonds for rental housing, but then the payments on that the owner of the rental property would have to make to us would have to be sufficient to cover the costs of our costs of borrowing. And the reason that we asked for nonprofit housing bonds with an appropriation bond is so that we could provide the rental housing to low and moderate income people. This housing won't work. It doesn't support debt the way, what we're talking about. If we're trying to rent to low-income people in neighborhoods where there's a lot of rehab needs frequently for the properties to begin with, we're talking about scattered site management for the most part, which is more expensive than if you're managing a 50-unit building. So our revenue bonds, which we can do, they won't satisfy this need.
So were the bonds that you issued last year after the session revenue bonds that did not serve low-income people then?
Madam Chair, over the years we issue revenue bonds on a regular basis, although we haven't been in the bond market as much in the last year or so. But we did issue nonprofit housing bonds for the bonds that were authorized 2 years ago. We issued those, I believe, in August. But those were appropriation bonds that you had already authorized. The rest of the bonding that we have done is always revenue bonds. And those, for the vast majority of that money, gets used for first-time home buyers. And that's what we've been doing for 30-plus years.
Thank you. So I'm You know, the bonding I'm referring to, the project that happened after the session was over, when there were some bonds were I believe, authorized, I don't know, by MHFA for the project. Representative Hayden, help me out here with the name of the project, the funding that the Well, the project that was, I believe there's some MHFA bonds were authorized after the session last year that are going towards a project, I believe in the north side, that
the city's land bank, or the
land bank, that's
how that worked.
Madam Chair, that that funding is not from revenue bonds. That is, we have a certain amount of money that we can make available on loans. That is not state appropriations, and is not, it was originally from revenue bonds, but it's the additional money that we've made over the course of years that we, by board action, must make housing investments at investment grade loans. So the land bank funding, which was $10 million, is a loan to the land bank at 5% that we will have regular payments on. So that is not, we didn't issue bonds for that, and it's not an appropriation. It is one of our many investments in housing that as I said, by board action must be investment grade and must return an interest rate of at least 5%.
And it was how many million dollars?
It was $10 million. This is one of a number of efforts that the agency has made to help North Minneapolis in their foreclosure crisis. We have provided $20 million in other funding to help North Minneapolis through the Housing Fund and the Greater Metropolitan Housing Corporation, and have used at least $1 million in state appropriations as well over the course of the last few years.
And Ms. Wright, it's an important purpose, and my interest here is looking at what other options there might be if the agency or the board is able to authorize $10 million when we're not in session to do something like that. I'm just wondering if that might be a similar source for the, you know, $400,000 we're talking about, much less than $1 million for the bonding that is recommended by the governor. I mean, as you know, our bill is much bigger than the governor's, you know, the bill that, yes, that several of us have here. But if there's a source that has been available to help come up with those kinds of dollars, I guess maybe we should meet with your board or something. I'm interested in knowing what, yeah, you know, what the options here, what the pool of...
Madam Chair, I feel like I'm missing something, because the money that was loaned to the land bank was loaned to the land bank where we're going to get an interest payment back.
Mm-hmm.
So we're acting as a bank, which is one of the major functions of the agency. If we would issue bonds for the rental housing in foreclosed areas, we have to be able to pay those bonds off. So we can't use the same pool of money that we loan out to, it's interest going out and interest going out and nothing coming back is the way I'm understanding what you're suggesting, and I don't see how it works with funds that I feel like I'm not explaining this very elegantly, but essentially the general fund funding allows us to essentially make a grant so that the cost of the housing then is affordable to low and moderate income people. If we borrow money, the agency borrows money to fund that activity, then it serves a different income level because the money has to be repaid, and it has to be repaid with an interest rate. So it's sort of like the difference between you go out and buy a house and go to a bank and get a loan for it, for your mortgage, as opposed to Habitat, which is able to, through their volunteer work and their fundraising, make a mortgage to somebody at 0%.
Well, President Hinton, did you want to weigh in on this?
Just a little bit. I think that the issue of the land bank in of itself, and we hadn't got a chance to chat about it. I mean, one of it was something that happened. And I think the confusion is that it happened, you know, outside of session and outside of the context of this committee. So there was just a lot of fact-finding to understand how that process worked. I think what I hear you saying, is that the land bank's loan, or the loan that it got from MHFA, has to be paid back at 5%. Thus, the land bank is developing homes at a market rate in which they expect a return. Is that right? I don't know if I'm saying that.
Representative Hayden, my understanding is that the land bank is doing a couple of things. They are relying on NSP dollars to reduce the cost, because those are essentially grant funds. They have done some fundraising to help cover the costs of borrowing money, and then they are acquiring properties through the First Look program, which they are able to acquire at a considerable discount. And so they are able to still sell the homes to moderate income households, but because the acquisition was at a discount, and because they are using NSP, coupling the land bank with NSP dollars, and because they have done some fundraising, they are able to sell the property at a cost that will cover their costs but still remain affordable to a moderate income household. Now, I just want to say one other thing. I appreciate that you're here 5 or 6 months out of the year. The Housing Finance Agency, as you know, has a board of directors. That board of directors meets every month. We regularly, every month, commit funding. So our funding activities are not confined to the 6 months that the legislature is here. In fact, we would not be doing our jobs if we only made funding decisions during the time that you were here. So the land bank was not unusual in that there was a funding decision made by the board. That happens, as I said, on a regular basis. It happens every month. So that there was nothing extraordinary about that in terms of the action happening. We have bond sales that occur when the legislature is not in session. Those bond sales are timed based on what's happening with the market and our cash flow needs. They are not timed around the legislative session. They can't, for business reasons, be done that way. So I just think it's important to keep in mind that there are lots of decisions that are made by the agency on a regular basis that that occur outside of the legislative session.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Hayden.
I can absolutely appreciate that. I think it's, I mean, you have to do the business the way that you do it and the best way that it fits for the folks that you serve. I just think that this issue has come up in the sense of the context of what you're doing and the scope of the work that you're doing. And quite frankly, it's in districts that I represent, Representative Clark represents, and others. And so part of what we have to do in and outside of the work in which you, the great work in which you and your agency does, is to be able to tell our constituents what is going on and what is happening. And when they have concerns or worries or try to figure out what's happening to their communities, they tend to call us to want to find out what is happening. And so out of great respect for the work that you do, which I absolutely do, I also think that it makes a heck of a lot of sense for us to figure out, maybe not to the detail, not to the micromanaging, but that if there are major initiatives that are going to go on, especially in the communities in which we represent, that we would have some sense of how that works, because then that helps us explain it to our constituents. So I think that you know, an opportunity like we are today, right before session, to, as we're trying to figure out some of these tough questions, to figure out kind of what is the land bank, or what happened, or how does a state agency interact with it, I think is important for us to know, and quite frankly, it's important for our constituents to know, because it is, as we know, very, very complex, and it's tough, but we also have people trying to figure out what is happening to their community. And I haven't always, you know, been informed, though I kind of hear about it from various places of the work that I've done, but I haven't always been briefed or informed, which then puts me in a tough situation, or quite frankly, when I called Chair Clark about this issue, put her in a tough situation of being able to explain how does the state agency, irrespective of if it is general fund money or not, how do they interact with a major, you know, pretty well, you know, a major initiative that is going to go on in the communities that we live in. So I respect the work that you and the agency does, but, you know, if you, I think, you know, the questions are just to try to help us understand the totality of this issue that we're facing.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I appreciate that. I think that I'm very good about returning phone calls, and if I had gotten a call about this, I would have been happy to answer any questions. We were under, frankly, in this particular decision, we were under some time pressures, because the city of Minneapolis that received $18 million or $19 million in NSP2 funds just last week needed to have a commitment on the land bank funding to demonstrate leverage to increase their likelihood of being funded under NSP2. So you could, and we did view our $10 million loan commitment as a way of leveraging federal grant money. And we were, and Minneapolis and St. Paul were very fortunate that they were able to receive nearly $40 million in this last funding round. It was, we were, and so we were approached by a major philanthropic organization and the cities about this proposal. And as I said, we were under considerable time pressure to make a decision on this in so that they could include it in their application for NSP2 funding.
Well, thank you. I think the plea is for some more communication. Phone goes both ways. This committee is really interested in initiatives, and I think that's why we're kind of have you on the spot today. We really want to know if you have some ideas that we can talk about now that would deal with, you know, what's going to be a very difficult, very, very difficult bonding situation for this committee. We don't have any cash. We have programs at the agency. We're asking your opinion, and I think we'd want to hear them now if there are some. It sounds like mostly, well, we had heard too last year, you know, I mean, we're able to have our first, 2 years ago, we're able to have our first bonding, nonprofit bonding outside of the committee, the debt service. But I remember being told that that probably was going to happen again. And so it was some warning about that. But we are now in a situation where we have to figure out, you know, how are we, I mean, what we can do with bonding is certainly very worthwhile. And I don't know if there's any other programs. We've been trying to look at some of the options within the agency. We had a little bit of a discussion the other day in your office. The committee has been, we did get a recommendation from our Republican caucus, and the lead Republican, Dan Severson, sent me a message today basically saying that they will have no recommendations. So, sorry to hear that, but it's up to us, it looks like, the rest of us here, to come forward with those recommendations. And and I guess we're looking for the best advice that you might have. One of the things that we had talked a little bit about was whether or not there might be some programs within the agency, like the Challenge Program, that could be a possible source. There may be others. That's why I'm asking about these bonding issues, what you are able to do. You know, part of the question, part of the problem is knowing the right questions to ask. I mean, we don't know what all of, I don't know what all of your opportunities are, you know, that the board can come up with creative solutions. So that's what we're asking. Do you have some that might be kind of lingering there? And if you do, we're interested. If not, if we're all in the same boat of, you know, there's no funding either from the governor or you know, what we're going to end up with, it looks like, is a cut to existing programs and a very difficult time to get any bonding. Although, I think one of the things I heard from my colleagues in terms of the geobonding is that we definitely want to support the geobonding, the $10 million, so that we can have public housing funded, and this committee won't have to pay for it, but it is just like the poorest of the poor, and as you mentioned earlier, the kind of investment that we need in housing that just can't be replaced anymore when it's deteriorating. It's really an important one that we'll probably disagree with the governor on and go forward and try to do what the agency originally wanted and what we think is appropriate. I don't hear any nays about that from the committee when we've talked about it. But we're very interested in, you know, kind of figuring out how to shape a proposal. And we'll do it. We'll be handing in something tomorrow. But I wanted to give every opportunity for everybody on this committee and the agency to try to help us look at this issue. So if you have any other advice or any committee members want to weigh in on this in any other way, we're interested in what options might be there.
Madam Chair, if I could
reserve funds,
say that
anything like that.
I feel like, as you know, the agency invests all of its money in affordable housing. So to say, do you have some money that you could spend for the debt service on these particular bonds, is not adding to the pot. It's just rearranging things. And if we felt like we could get to where we were trying to go with our bonding request with existing resources, then we would have made another request that we couldn't have used existing resources for, or we wouldn't have made a request. So we're trying to expand the resources that were available and have housing continue to be part of the capital, the state's capital investment. We thought we had come up with 2 years ago a creative way to have the state continue to make capital investments in housing, just as it makes capital investments in parks and trails and zoos, mm-hmm. and historic buildings and other things. We will continue. We have, as you know, we have established a strategic priority for foreclosure recovery efforts. I'm expected back for a board meeting that starts in about 5 minutes to talk about additional points in our qualified allocation plan for tax credits being the major driver of rental housing development and redevelopment, to add additional points for foreclosure recovery efforts. So we will deploy our resources as creatively as we can. We were simply asking for more. If that's, I understand that it's a really tough budget situation, but I'm not sure that it advances things to ask us to not do something else that we already have a commitment for in order to pay the debt service on some nonprofit bonds.
Excuse me, could you just clarify that when you say when you already have a commitment for?
Well, we already, as you know, we have a budget and a plan for how we're spending the money. And I provided you with information about how we are doing in terms of committing the state's appropriation. We are, I think, about 58% of the way through the fiscal year. We've committed almost 75% of the money already, and we've actually committed some FY10 money or 11 money as well. So we don't have resources. We wouldn't be doing our job if we had resources that were not being invested in housing, and all of our resources are currently being invested in housing.
Well, I understand that although you do have unobligated funds right now in several of your projects, several of your programs.
We
correct?
Do, Madam Chair. So
just looking
we
at
are,
a chart of that.
We do have several months left in the fiscal year. I think that it's not unusual to not have committed all of your money by, 7 months into the fiscal year.
Right, and I don't mistake me. I'm not saying you should have committed them. I'm just saying that you do have some uncommitted ones, mm-hmm. which, at least for those of us who have to figure out how to make this thing work, that at least provides us, you know, an opportunity to think about those, because we would not be breaking any promises that have, you know, they're unobligated right now.
Madam Chair, but if we were authorized to issue nonprofit housing bonds, the bonds would be outstanding for 20 years. Mm-hmm. So even if you took, let's say, $400,000 out of unobligated general fund appropriations that you've already made to the agency and expected that that would take care of the debt service, that would only take care of the debt service for 2 years.
Right.
And unless we had a standing appropriation for that, we could not issue the bonds, because the bonds, you know, we wouldn't be able to sell the bonds, because bondholders would not feel confident that they would be repaid. What happened 2 years ago is you made a standing appropriation to pay the debt service on those bonds. So I don't think that the two-year appropriation to our base is a rely. It is not a a source that that we can use to pledge for the debt service on the bonds for the next 20 years.
I think we'll have to do a little talk with some bond counsel about that.
Well, Madam Chair,
I'm confident that
there is a significant difference between a standing appropriation and a biennial appropriation.
Yes.
And what we have in our base that's unobligated now is a biennial appropriation. We can't pledge that we're going to have that for the next 20 years. The legislature pledged, you know, made a standing appropriation for the $30 million in nonprofit housing bonds 2 years ago.
Well, I think, at least for me, where this comes back to is, you know, we're in a crisis situation. I think you were here for some of the hearing before. I mean, despite our Republican colleagues' recommendations to do nothing, I'm pretty sure we will not be doing that. So please feel free to stay in touch with us and figure out how, if there's some ways that we can work on, you know, moving this whole housing crisis forward and coming up with some creative way to deal with the issue. Are there any other comments from committee members? Anything you want to weigh in on? Representative Lane.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to come out of a state of confusion. So the governor's recommendation for $5 million in nonprofit housing bonds with $400,000 in debt service, that $400,000 in debt service, we're saying we need to cover in a different way than it has been in the past. So then I guess my question would be that, does the MHFA wish to have any of this? I remember you saying you'd have to look long and hard if that were the case, and so do you have a long and a hard shortly now?
Madam Chair, sorry. Representative, I discussed this briefly with the commissioner yesterday. Our initial reaction was that it's probably not in the long run a good idea for us to have a $800,000 biennial cut to our base, or whatever the number, you know, it would be $800,000 if it were $5 million. That's probably not a good trade-off. And we would not recommend it.
Thank you.
Representative Hayden, did you want to speak to this?
No.
Okay. All right. And I guess just before you leave, I'm sorry. Sorry, just one more quick question. Give me walking back and forth. In terms of the $10 million bonding proposal for public housing,
uh-huh.
You want to speak to that?
Madam Chair, it was part of our request.
Oh, okay. We'll leave it at that then. Representative, did you have your hand up? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you did. Okay. Did that help, Representative Lane?
I hope so.
Okay. Thank you very much, committee members. Thank you, Zora and others, for participating in today. I'm going to be in my office drafting a memo in the next few hours, and if any of you want to come and weigh in on it, let me know. Okay? The meeting is adjourned.